Accession number 19929, Reel 1.
Colonel Taylor, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Madrid.
Which year was this?
1920.
Were you then a Spanish subject?
No, my father had a job in Madrid after the Great War, having been assistant naval attaché there in the war.
So your father and mother were English?
English.
How long did you stay in Madrid for?
Was that period about 2 years, I suppose. When my father, well, I was ill, and so they all went back to England.
Where did you settle down in England?
Well, settled in a strange way, Oxfordshire, Nettlebed. And then my father got a job at Rio Tinto, and we all moved out to South Spain, to Rio Tinto, which is near Huelva.
So you were fluent in the Spanish language?
No. There are a few words, mainly to the cook.
Where did you go to school?
Well, first of all, I went to prep school in Kent, Bickley Hall, near Chislehurst, and then I was trying to get in the Navy, and so I failed Dartmouth exam, and went first of all to HMS Conway, which is one of the training ships. There's HMS Conway, HMS Worcester, in the Thames, Conway in the Mersey, and Pangbourne. Which is a Norton College, or was, where they took every term, 3 terms a year, they took one person from those 3 places who then joined the term they'd missed at Dartmouth. Well, I failed there too. So I finally went to a Newton College, which has now been absorbed by Kelly College in Devonshire.
How old were you when you finished there?
Well, I finished 17, I suppose, yes. I went to Crammers in Kent and then went to Sandhurst in 1938, so I was coming up for 18.
What did you think of your course at Sandhurst?
Well, it was very clever, because we all got there in August, 39, and as you know, the war broke out. And we moved straight into a 4-month course. I mean, it was all well organized. We never noticed anything. We moved straight into a 4-month course, which is the equivalent of an OCTU course, as they were known later on, officer cadet training unit courses, which went on during the war. Although we remain, I'm happy to say, gentlemen cadets. And so then I got commissioned, therefore, on 31st of December, 39, whereas I should have been commissioned about a year later, had the war not broken out.
Which regiment were you commissioned into?
Into West Yorkshire's.
Any particular reason for that?
Yes, a great friend of mine had joined them, you know, and being born abroad and living a lot abroad, didn't matter where, as regards counties. I didn't really have any particular county connection.
Where did you first make the acquaintance of the West Yorkshire's?
When I went up to in January 40.
Whereabouts was this?
York.
Can you
at
tell
the
me,
depot.
Can you tell me about the depot at York, please?
In what way? I mean,
your experience of that?
Well, it wasn't very long. It was very crowded because, of course, hundreds and hundreds of officers were coming in. I remember the typical army welcome. First night, I and another chap who'd come up from Sandhurst were welcomed and sat down in what we used to call the bum wall, you know, the thing surrounding a fire, and you sit down. And very welcome, the next night the other chap tried to sit down. It was booted to the other end of the room. That was your welcome, then you forget it. But no, they were very good, very efficient. And then in due course, I got posted, in my case, to the 2nd, 5th Battalion, 2nd because of the doubling up of the TA, who had been in France and had come back in some disarray actually, when they went to France, not every man had a weapon, which is a rather odd thing.
When did you join the battalion, about?
So I joined the first, I joined the second fifth, you see, and then, a thing called a holding battalion first. I was there for about 5 months. I was in Witherby, and then joined the second fifth, about September, 40, something like that.
Did you see anything of the Battle of Britain?
Well, really, no, because it was up there or in Scotland, probably, so we didn't see much of it, or enjoy anything of it, really. And then, just quickly do the thing, I became the anti-tank platoon commander. Then they brigaded them, as they're called. In other words, they got the ones from the other two battalions together with mine and made an anti-tank company. And then when they started forming the reconnaissance corps, which is an entire invented in the Great War and no longer exists, and was to take the place of light cavalry in armoured cars, while they transferred into heavy tanks, as a general idea, and each division had one. And so I became part of 46th Reconnaissance Regiment of the Recce Corps, or 46th Battalion, sorry. And moving around England, which is what people did most of the time, convoys going all over the place. I was then transferred to 45 Recce. In each case, we were equipped with Bren gun carriers and a very light and very lightly armoured car. And as a platoon commander, I had seven carriers and five armoured cars. It was a rather nice command.
What did you think of the equipment and its performance?
Well, because the Bren gun carrier, if used properly, was brilliant. I mean, the idea was to take a Bren gun across this open ground from here to there. But in practice, of course, people don't use them sort of like tanks. But they're very clever in a number of ways to pick up wounded on those ones. There wasn't a lot of room on them, but they were very, very versatile. The armoured cars were hopeless. I mean, they were too light. Still, I never had to go to war in them. So I don't know.
At this time, did you think that England was going to be invaded by Germany?
Yes, that was a general idea. And indeed, we were up in Scotland at the time when we heard the bells tolling. We were summoned from dinner at the local hotel looking like the Battle of Waterloo. So and off we went to our posts, but nothing happened. It was an error. But oh yes, if you were either on coastal defence or you were within.
What did you think at that time would be the likely outcome of the Germans invading?
They would lose. I mean, one never thought otherwise.
What made you so confident?
Germans always seem a joke, even to this day. But in practice, everybody was quite confident. There was no feeling, oh my God, the Americans must come in or anything like that. I didn't think that at all. Though obviously, if they hadn't, we would have lost for it. And everybody was like that, you know.
Did you listen to Churchill broadcasts?
Oh yes. Everybody did. And in those days, if you went to a pub, the parlour or the snug, that one, or the saloon, would be reserved for officers and the public bar for soldiers. But they'd all listen, you'd hear them listening to the thing and giving a bravo or a cheer every now and then.
What effect did his speeches have on you?
Well, very, very good. Very good.
Did you listen in to Lord Haw Haw?
Yes. Well, not sort of deliberately, but heard him once or twice. He was so ridiculous in a way, I don't know why they fussed about him. But he had that sort of irritating voice.
And so you were training at this time in Britain with the 45 recce?
Yes. 46 first and then 45. And then we ordered us to pack up and go, we thought, to the Middle East. Anyway, we embarked in Liverpool. Quite interesting. I was made... I did some misdemeanor, I forgot what it was, I didn't turn up for physical training one morning or something, so I was made baggage officer. And we were in Hereford at the time, and with my baggage party we managed to load onto the train, I forget how many tons, 70 more tons, of stuff, the heavy stuff going separately, up to Liverpool, unloaded in Lime Street, loaded on trucks, unloaded on the dock, and then nothing would ever happen. My CEO said to me, I believe the stevedore was making a lot of trouble there, so don't stand any nonsense. So like a bloody fool, I went up, I was on board now, I couldn't get off, and I went up to the ship's office and said, look what the hell's happening, there's all our kit, they're not going on the ship. He said, well, don't ask me, but they're down there in the hold. So I went down to the hold, and they were playing cards. My sort of pip started to disappear, you know, from everybody saying yes. So Chaplin said, what do you want, Sonny? So, of course, it had absolutely disappeared by then. So I said, well, I say, you know, like Bertie Wooster, I say, you know, what are you all doing? I said, he was dummy or something. He said, listen, Sonny, it's Sunday, see? And we get paid time and a half for the longer that we take. So we're going to take a very long time. Got it? Now run along. They'd just been bombed 10 days before. This was the attitude. And you've probably come across it again when loading tanks and all that. It was quite extraordinary, the attitude of workers of that sort. Anyway, so I know you want to be everybody in uniform, you're going to get the proper respect. But there are. So we found we didn't go to the Middle East. We went to India, Bombay, and to a delightful place called Ranchi. It really was nice. R-E-N-C-H-I. A sort of semi-hill station, really. Very pleasant. There we joined the 70th Division, which was an experienced division, a pre-war regular. The 6th Division, I think, pre-war. They'd already fought in the Middle East, so on. And these are the fellows who then got seized upon to be engines for the second expedition, when it was given all these brigades. And that's how, you know, after training, mucking around in India. Well, incidentally, yes, we were then unhorsed, so to speak, because we were now going to be going in the second wing of the expedition. We didn't call it Jindits, but that's... And I think now, in retrospect, what we did too much of was marching. Marching, you know, and all sort of thing, getting used to marching and that sort of thing. And really, rather exhausting ourselves before we went in, and in our case, 16 Brigade walked in. So I think we were pretty tired before we even started. And we didn't concentrate enough on proper training for proper action. Anyway, 16 Brigade, we marched in, which was a hell of a performance, you probably read about it. And the idea, I think, was that we would surprise the Japanese by marching in. But not marching, walking in, getting in. Because, of course, at the beginning it was terrifically hilly and slippery and rain. It was a really arduous performance. But when we got to our thing, which is called Aberdeen, a place called Manton, M-A-H-N-T-O-N, codenamed Aberdeen, where there's a very good sort of what we call a fortress, and there's two or three little hills that you could be on, cover the airstrip and make an airstrip and cover it and so on. And then it flew in the other two brigades, where they looked like gods. I mean, we've been going along on a K ration designed for 48 hours, we've been doing this for another month, absolutely tired out. These are fellas, right? Fits fills, they look like it's another country. And to add to that, we'd hardly got to Aberdeen when we ordered off to do an attack on Indore. And I mean, I'm jumping all the business of crossing the chimney and all that sort of thing.
Can you go back to that thing?
Yes, well, we didn't, because it was unopposed. But it was quite a thing to finally get across it. All right, mules across and swim. And the kit went in. You made boats out of ground sheets for pushing the kit across and that sort of thing. Everybody carried about, I think it's about 70 pounds on their feet. And we all had rifles so that you couldn't be picked out as an officer with a pistol sung by Jeremy snipers. Everybody carried a full pack with some specified exceptions. The commanders of the columns and commanders of the sort of infantry company and one or two others. And this was well accepted by the men because it was well explained that if they were exhausted, then we'd all be buggered when they ended the march, you know. So that if your column commander was fitter, he was fit enough to go around and see everything was in position, you know, for the night or whatever, and could make decisions, which he probably couldn't do if he was exhausted. And that was perfectly accepted, as was the famous flogging, which you've heard about it all.
No.
Wingate said that you can't punish a man for doing certain things, putting the column into danger by, say, trying to sleep with a Burmese woman, or stealing the rations from the supply drop, or things like that. It's no good giving him 28 ACB or saying you'll be court martialed, so what you'll be is you'll be flogged. This was accepted by the men too, and done. Because two of my chaps did pinch rations, and the CO was so bloody wet, he told me to destroy all their chocolate, which of course typically, although they'd been cheating their friends instantly gave them chocolate back. I mean, they're simply typically British. But, yes, and indeed, there was a famous court martial after the war in London, a chap called Graves Morris, and he was found not guilty because of condemnation of superior military authority. That didn't work in Nuremberg. Condemnation of superior authority was not accepted there, thank God, in our case it was. But there, again, the trouble was only that two of these chefs, going back to their hometown, started reminiscing what had happened to the other, and mentioned this, and one of them, first thing, there was an up-and-coming Labour councillor, hoping to be an MP and this thing, and he raised it all, and then, of course, the papers got out of it. It was quite a performance. But no, if a thing is properly explained to everybody, then they'll accept it. They can see the reason for that. So it may sound odd, you know, flogging only stopped the British Army about 100 years earlier. But now the punishment will do. Also, not on your back, because you've got to carry your pack. You know, things like that. But in our case, we didn't do it. These are all to do with putting the column in danger. Or otherwise. So, well, Chinrin, it was a sort of marking place because in the first expedition they got over the Chinrin, and then they got into all their trouble and had to break up into small groups and go back. And we were designed the column into groups, which if whistles blew and dispersal was ordered, it would break up into these small groups and go to the first RV, and if that was no good, there was a second RV. And if that was no good, you worked your way back to Indo. That was the general idea. And so, when we launched forth indoors, there's the Queen's and the Leicester's and ourselves to indoor, we came to a place called Thetkagin. Well, you know, I was what they call a recce platoon commander. I had two sections of British soldiers, ours, and one section of Burmese. But in my case, unfortunately, well, they were all right, but Burmans, in other words, townsmen from down, and not hillmen, which is what you, well, the best Koreans or Kachins. Anyway, so as that recce platoon commander on the way, and I'd been liaising between the column in front of us and all that, now I'm guard for the CO's group, you know, provided he called me guard. So all I didn't force me attack I'm trying to take this because you're taking with our packs on, the heavy pack. Now, against this came a whole lot of Japanese, in fact, a PT kit who'd come out of the local garrison, you know. I mean, the thing was absolutely hopeless, and it was hopeless. So the CO ordered dispersal. But as we approached the place he'd chosen, you could see Japanese were there. So he sat down. He was, I should say, of course, again, going everything backwards. He was over, I think the Mystic Age was 36. He wasn't supposed to go in. And he was over it. And he was also a great gent. He wouldn't have his pack carried. He would never ask the men to do what he wouldn't do himself. It was always absolutely played out at this point. And so there he was, annoying his thing. He said to me, well, I've changed the rendezvous to here, the second rendezvous, I've changed it. And now you go. And I went with my batman and a sergeant and one Burman to try and find the other elements of the column and tell them where the new rendezvous was. And so off I went. And I did. I luckily found the mules. It was coming and gleaming, and the mules of the mortar platoon, and told them where to go. And then the company under an excellent fellow called Ron Adams, and he collected together one or two others so as to make a bigger force. And I called him and told him where the next place was. And then there was still the Pierce anti-tank projectile section, one or two others, and coming over the ridge, there they were. So I stepped forward and shouted the code word, which was Nanking or something. Anyway, and they all stopped dead. And I said it again, my mouth coming rather dry, and suddenly they're all Japanese. And fortunately, my sergeant, marvellous chap, shouted, "This way, sir!" And he fired away and made these other chaps fire away, and it sounded they thought they might have run into an outpost. And I was able to run straight into a thicket where I lost my rifle and pack and everything else, and joined them. Because now we're not in jungle, we're in teak country, which is grown trees, so there's plenty of. You're not covered from view very much. And the leaves are down, so the noise. However, I found the track of the company, and we went along there as far as we could, and then went to sleep, and then went on the next day, found them. I'm telling you this terribly badly, because, of course, what I should have said automatically is, we're already terribly short of water. For some reason or other, we left Aberdeen with the full water bottles, that sort of thing. Water discipline had rather broken down because there'd never been any trouble. And suddenly there was none, you know, and it's amazing how it affects you. You try to ring the stone in your mouth, you know, something like that. So, finding the company, I then went with the Burmese to a Burmese hut, and they said, and we could see there was water there. They said the Japanese there. So I was able to say, look, there is water here, but the Japanese are in position, so, you know, tricky, but the mules and the men ran for the water, and it was sprayed. So a lot of chaff.
And what? Sorry.
Was sprayed, you know, with automatic fire from the jets. And that's where Ron Adams was had to be left, or wounded. So who knows what happened to him? And I found myself with about half a dozen chaps. Mainly of my equipment, and we hid up in the what they call Lentana, which is, you know, which is funny, very useful stuff, but apparently it was introduced into Burma by planters and teak men for their gardens. They spread like wildfire, and so it did give cover in this rather bare area, and they managed to get back, going by night, get back to Aberdeen. Where remnants of the column collected. The CO, could be the honourable whitewashing, but in fact he was sort of flown out and got rid of. And in due course, the Burma Rifles chap took over. And I say we were still pretty fagged. And rumours kept going and we were going to be flown out, you know, and sort of rested, but not a bit of it. We were then loaned to 77 Brigade, which is Mike Calvert's brigade. You've probably heard of him. And Bernard Ferguson thought we were going to fly into the White City, because you could land there and get into what they called the White City, which is a marvellous road and rail block of low hills. Calvert was under the impression there on the contrary. And so, in fact, instead of flying in, we were to do ourselves and Gurkhas and the next shoes of Azuma, a bit of a muddle, because this was another brigade now, to attack the people who were attacking, who were investing the White City. We were still doing this sort of jungle warfare business. We went in jungle, you know, single file. The whole thing was single file until you met anybody, two scouts and so on. So up we went, and I was leading, in fact, with my lot. In fact, I was leading as I was just behind the scouts. And there was some firing, and there was some firing to the right, but we managed to get through and get along the Chong stream bank. And then we got over, and then we were held, pinned down, and nobody else came over. And then after a bit, they decided to pull out. But they'd done some quite good damage, as it turned out. In fact, it was successful, though, you wouldn't have thought so. And I was told to go back to where we dropped the packs, because this time we had dropped our big packs. And that was about 4 or 5 miles south with the Nigerians. And they were holding a roadblock there and looked after our stuff there. And the only thing on the way back, well, by this time, I don't know, I got about half a dozen men, no more. Everybody had disappeared in all directions. I came across one of our soldiers, Corporal Brown, giving water in his hat to a sergeant who had been shot right through, and he received the bullet still sticking out here and was blind.
Right through his temple.
Yes, he was all right, you see, except he was blind. Couldn't see anything. This chap had not deserted him, which was really terrific, because people did, they just went, you know. And he had stayed with him and was going to go with him all the way. Bloody good, well, I was able to pick them up, of course, and bring them along with me. And yesterday, when we were in India and training again, and a CO who had been in Italy at the time of this action was very interested in the story. He said, "Tell me the story." He said, "I'm going to get him the MM." He said, "The big thing with these things is more margins. If you're going to write a recommendation for decoration, you must leave 2 margins either side where people can write." And by God, he got him. He wasn't even there. He got him, the MM. And Brown said, "I don't know what the fuss was. Anybody would have done the same." But he was wrong, because they wouldn't, actually. That was a sort of bright moment.
What's the significance of these margins?
Well, it just looks pretty. But he knew, he'd come from Europe, and he knew the form. We would have written the thing on a costume. You would leave margins, then somebody could write, "Jolly good," or "I agree," or something like that. See? But I was always impressed by this. Remember, margins. And so then, really, we were pretty well, but we only had one more bump. We did a bit of wandering about, which I can't really figure out, but I think we were by now ordered out for Broadway, which was the name of the main airfield that they had achieved, flown all these other brigades in, and was still not only lightly attacked by the Japanese, if at all. It was about a 2 or 3 day march. And at some point, when of course Gallant, me leading again, we bumped into some Japanese, so everybody, they were terribly shaken, and they fled, really, galloping away. So, I'm 4 hours now. I had the 2 scouts in front of me, and 2, yes, I think with 4 of us, actually, yes, had to pull out, and we found the Nigerians, and they put me on course for our own column. And I found my own column. And they were getting rather tired of my turning up when they'd written me off.
Rather tired of what?
Well, me coming back, you know. They've